The federal government is relaxing restrictions on growing marijuana for research.
That's something that's very positive for science and very positive for the research community.
We'll talk with the Brookings Institution's John Hudak about the DEA's new policy to allow more research on the potential benefits of medical marijuana. Also, how a policy to help employ people with a criminal past may be backfiring. And as technology becomes more common in Illinois K-12 classrooms, Illinois State University professor Rena Shiflett says schools need to learn how to adapt.
So economically, even in small rural districts, I mean, if they have the technology, they also need to have the infrastructure. If more classrooms are going one-to-one, even with Chromebooks that are all web-based kinds of technologies, you still have to have the infrastructure to support that within your building.
We'll speak with St. Joseph Grade School's principal about how he's adapting technology for his school. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The research benefits of medical marijuana aren't that well known simply because the federal government has so far limited the amount of marijuana that can be grown to be studied for research. But last month, the Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA, announced they're allowing more people to start growing marijuana for research in the U.S. They did so even though they're still classifying marijuana as a drug akin to heroin and LSD, which have no medical value. If the DEA's policy on this sounds a little confusing, it's a reflection of the ambiguity around medical marijuana. To help us make sense of all of this is John Hudak. He's an expert on policies surrounding marijuana for the Brookings Institution. In a few minutes, we'll also hear from a medical marijuana dispenser in Southern Illinois. But let's start with John. Hey, John, welcome to the 21st.
Nyla, thanks for having me.
I know the U.S. government is now starting to open doors for other marijuana research to take place, but for about the past 50 years, is it correct the U.S. relied on one single grower to produce marijuana, use it for research? I imagine that's been limiting for the amount of research that could take place around the benefits of medical marijuana.
That's right. For the past about 50 years, the University of Mississippi has had the only federal contract to grow research-grade marijuana, and that marijuana is the only product that is allowed to be used in federally approved marijuana studies in the United States. And that really has held back research in a variety of ways. It's not the only thing that's held back research, but it certainly has become a hindrance for a lot of researchers across the U.S.
What else has held it back? I imagine there's a lot of complications involved for scientists who want to be using marijuana for medical research.
Yeah, there's a few complications. First, as a Schedule I substance, the licensure requirements, the security requirements, and the certifications that are necessary just to allow a researcher to conduct a study on the plant to make sure that that product can be in a given university lab and around the research assistants and others who will be working on it is costly, it's time-consuming, and it's a difficult process. That's one step. In addition to that, there has really been a bias against studies that are looking into medical efficacy of marijuana. For the longest time, the only marijuana studies that were being approved were ones that talked about abuse and not about medical value. And so that created a really serious system in which the right types of research wasn't being done.
Well, you've mentioned schedule, so that's how the DEA classifies drugs. So as the DEA last month announced that they would invite or allow more growers across the country to apply for a license to grow marijuana for medical research, they still kept marijuana as under a classification of a drug that doesn't have medical value.
Yeah, that's right. And this is something that was perplexing to many in the policy reform community, the marijuana reform community, because these are individuals who look around every day and see people who are claiming to have medical benefit from marijuana. And there is research out there that points to medical value from certain parts of the plant, certain chemicals in the plant. But the differences between what a reformer or a patient or a dispensary owner considers to rise to that level of medical value is very different than what that standard is in the medical community. The medical community wants a lot of research and gold standard research, that is double-blind studies with placebos, to make sure that they are ruling out every other explanation for a patient's symptoms or a patient's relief. And marijuana hasn't really been demonstrated to that standard yet.
That's John Hudak. He's a senior fellow in governance studies joining us from the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. I want to bring someone else into this conversation. John mentioned dispensaries. Cameron Lehman is one of the founders of Harbury. It's a medical marijuana dispensary in Marion, Illinois. Hey, Cameron, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Cameron, as we're hearing John talk about this, we know that medical marijuana, as we've seen increasingly states allowing medical marijuana use, but as John's explaining, we don't have very much research knowing the different effects of medical marijuana. How does that affect you? So if someone comes into Harbury, a doctor gives a patient a prescription for medical marijuana, when they come, how would that work if they were coming into a dispensary?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the way it actually works is it's not technically a prescription. The doctor is just giving what's called a recommendation. So the doctor has just said, in my professional opinion, you have one of the qualifying conditions that allow you to use cannabis in the state of Illinois. And in my medical opinion, you benefit from the use of cannabis, but it's not, in fact, a specific prescription.
Thanks for that distinction. So they come in with the certification, and then what happens when they come into a dispensary?
Absolutely. So once you come into Harbury, our wellness specialists will see you. They will talk about your medical history, ask you questions, you know, what are your conditions, what are your symptoms, et cetera, and then based on what kind of application you'd like, maybe you prefer to eat an edible on your cannabis, or maybe it's a sublingual tincture, and then depending on your age and your sex and your weight, they will make a recommendation as to what kind of medical cannabis they think you should have. Now, to the point about research, we are very limited in what we can do because all that we have at our disposal is the data that we've accumulated from nearly a year of operating and then anecdotal evidence from our members who come to Harbury saying, in the past, strains X, Y, and Z have worked for me and strains A, B, and C have not. But that is a significantly limited pool of information that we have. And if we were to have more research, that would dramatically improve our ability to treat each of our members and more rapidly come to the best strain of medical cannabis for them.
Yeah. John, I wonder, as you're hearing Cameron discuss this, I mean, I imagine this is probably true for most medical marijuana dispensaries across the country because there isn't, is there research right now about these specific strains are helpful for chemotherapy or what else? That, it doesn't sound like that really exists right now, does it, John?
There are some researchers who are trying to get into that for a variety of ailments, whether it's dealing with the effects of chemotherapy, whether it is, multiple sclerosis or epilepsy disorders or a variety of things. But what Cameron describes is something that's fairly common across the United States. And I think to his credit and to the credit of a lot of other dispensary owners and employees across the U.S., they're doing the best that they can. They're accumulating this data and they're trying to make sure that the experience that their patients, their customers have is as positive and as effective of one as possible. And so what I think Cameron's actually selling himself a bit short. A lot of these dispensaries are getting tremendous amounts of data about which strains, what composition, the relationship between THC and CBD and other cannabinoids in the plant are best for certain conditions, certain age groups, certain genders, certain cross conditions. And so when someone comes in, Cameron won't know necessarily exactly what strain is going to help that person, but he will probably be able to narrow the list down. And I think that's just responsible business practice, particularly when you're dealing with people who are ill and in some cases terminally ill.
John, can you explain? You mentioned a couple terms, THC, CBD. What's that?
Sure. THC and CBD are chemical components found in the cannabis plant. THC is the most commonly known chemical. It is the part of the plant that gets you high, that has psychoactive effects. CBD is a chemical called cannabidiol. It does not have that high-inducing effect, but it is found in the cannabis plant, and research suggests that it has neuroprotective qualities, and it has the in some cases, the ability to deal with conditions like MS and like epilepsy without giving the patient that high that a THC-heavy strain would give you.
John, I wonder, as we're talking about all of this and we're talking about the research, do you think that there is probably a stigma against scientists who are doing research on this? I am thinking just apart from even now the DEA has made this move and maybe opened it up a little bit more, but I imagine there's probably just a big stigma within the scientific community about people taking this research seriously.
Well, I think increasingly people are taking marijuana research more seriously than, 10, 15, 20 years ago, particularly as medical marijuana has become such a prolific part of public policy. But at the same time, those biases exist. They exist in the research community. They exist in universities. They exist among institutional review boards. They exist among peer reviewers who are reading studies during the publication process. And those biases that you see in, criminal justice and in everyday aspects of life around marijuana also seep into the scientific community, and that makes research all that much harder.
Cameron, how do you think more research would help the process that you've described?
For sure, and I think bias and the perceptions around medical cannabis certainly have an effect within the member community as well. If those studies proving efficacy are more readily available within the member and the patient community in a town like Marion, you're going to see people read those things and start to have a little bit of a better feeling about medical cannabis for general perceptions. And so when members that come to us come in, and many of them say, my friend found out that I was using this and they looked down on me for that and measured this time and time again, I do think that would have a significant impact in terms of how people are perceived in the community. And as far as within the walls of the dispensary, what that will do for our researchers, for our wellness specialists, is if there is more research, and to John's point, there have been researches and studies done about different conditions, but if we get down to the strain level of specificity with some of these plants and some of the cannabinoids, then we can really start to say, okay, for a woman who's 45 and has MS, in 76% of the cases, we have seen that this specific strain of cannabis is going to help you with these conditions. And that's really just going to, again, dramatically increase the efficacy that we have in diagnosing and then in helping our members.
Cameron, what were the reactions from you and from your members about marijuana not being reclassified as we're talking about the DEA and as the DEA at the one moment opened up and said we're allowing different people to apply for permits to grow marijuana, to do medical research. They also capped the schedule classification of marijuana as not having any medical value. Was that something that you found disappointing?
Absolutely. And it's a great question. And I'm certainly an expert on the policy side, and I can only speak from sort of this management perspective. And the conflicting message there to me is you're allowing more research while, just to your point, saying, but in fact, there is no medical benefit. And day in and day out, we see people come to us, and the story arc is very similar across the board. What you hear is, I was on 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 different types of painkillers, opioids, you name it. And because I've moved to medical cannabis, I've been able to wean myself off of those harmful pills. I no longer feel very lethargic. I'm no longer a zombie. And I'm using this one plant to supplement all of these harmful other pills that I was using. And so we have seen anecdotally, time and again, the benefits that this has. And so for us to hear the DEA say it has zero medical benefit and high potential for addiction is confusing. And I was saying this just the other day, it's one thing for me as the manager and founder of the dispensary to say that, but can you imagine what it would be like for a member or a patient to hear the DEA say there's no medical value when you would be the one who has given up all of these different harmful pills for in exchange for this one plant? I mean, what kind of message does that send to you as a user of medical cannabis? I mean, I can't even
Right.
fathom what that must
yeah,
be.
Like. Cameron. Thanks for that. Thanks for that, Cameron, because I know that, John, there was actually a Federal Registry policy report from the DEA in August that said that no drug product made from marijuana has yet to be shown to be safe and effective in clinical trials. Is that accurate?
Well, that's a bit of an overstatement. There have been clinical trials in the United States throughout the world that have shown real medical value. In fact, the FDA, who is in on any rescheduling decision as part of the law, currently has approved to a stage 3 trial a medicine that is made out of a component of cannabis, real cannabis, not synthetic cannabis. And so that statement, it has a very cloudy relationship with reality, I would say, not just in the United States, but in Western Europe, in Israel, and elsewhere throughout the world. To say that there is insufficient evidence, I think, is probably something that the medical community can stand by. But to suggest that there is no evidence really is just not correct.
John, we just have about a minute or so left, but I just wanted to ask you if part of the problem seems to be that when you have sort of traditional drug manufacturers, they're kind of pushing the process of clinical trials. They're working with the FDA. Is part of this with marijuana just that it's much more scattered and there isn't an infrastructure? There isn't, say, one or two companies that have the organization and the lobbying power and the history with the FDA to be able to be doing this?
Well, I think in terms of marijuana enterprises, they certainly don't have the lobbying power with FDA to do that. For pharmaceutical companies, however, certainly no one could underestimate their lobbying power in government and specifically before FDA. But I do think you are seeing companies like GW Pharmaceuticals really starting to step into this space. And the future of medical marijuana will probably be some combination of normal pharmaceuticals like we think of them today, as well as a peer system of dispensaries like the one Cameron runs.
Right. I want to thank Cameron Lehman for joining us with Harbury Medical Marijuana Dispensary in Marion, Southern Illinois. Thanks also to John Hudak. He's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. And John, you have a book coming out next month, Marijuana, A Short History?
Yes, that's right.
All right. Thanks.
Available October 25th.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Coming up, we're going to be talking about technology in classrooms across Illinois K-12 schools. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As K-12 schools across Illinois settle into their school year, increasingly alongside teachers, students are using tablets, computers, and smart boards. But how are schools adapting to technology, especially given the tenuous and challenging funding situations for public education in Illinois? Mike Sennert is a principal of St. Joseph Grade School. It's about 10 miles east of Urbana. He's made adaptation to technology a key focus of his school, which has about 400 K through 4th grade students. He's in studio with me now. Hi, Mike, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What kind of devices and technology do your students use throughout the district on a day-to-day basis?
Okay, throughout the district, in the kindergarten through second grade classrooms, we have iPads, the tablets in place. There currently are 6 in each classroom that they use for their center time to reinforce. A lot of ours is driven by our newest curriculums we've adopted. With the curriculum in our reading language arts curriculum and our math curriculum, both have a huge online component that has additional practice. It has activities at home that parents can log on and do with the students. And actually, it can reteach lessons, and the books are all available online for the parents. So the primary level, they use the tablets just to do reinforcement activities in their centers. Then when we get to 3rd through 8th grade students in our district, we have Chromebook devices in all of our classrooms, and they have 7 to 11, depending on the money that we've gotten contributed from our parent-teacher club and also our general budget. And in those, of course, they're also using the online resources, but we're also a Google Apps school, which means we have free access to all the Google Apps that we use in education. There's Google Classroom, there's Google Docs, Google Spreadsheets, and the teachers have, within the last 2 years, really incorporated switching over from the Office products to the Google products to use with their classrooms. And I have some impressive ones in our middle school building that are actually doing more paperless classrooms with the Google.
Oh, because the students have Chromebook.
Yes.
So how much does your school budget for technology every year? How much of that has changed within your budget in the past couple of years?
Right. We are a smaller rural district, and out of the general education fund, my superintendent, I'm also the technology coordinator for the district. He allows me a certain amount each year. And depending on the years with the state funding, as you know, my budget has went down a little bit each year, but still 40 to 50,000 we put toward education technology, the repairs, the advancement. But we also have a very strong, we call ours the PTC, but they're typically PTAs, our parent teacher club. And they have been doing a fundraiser every spring. And over the last 2 years, they've donated $27,000 to our schools.
And so that's where most of it sounds like the bulk,
yes,
of the funding comes from that. Why is it so important for you to have this available for the student population?
Oh, heavens. When 20 years ago, when I was in elementary school, you know, it was the textbooks and it was your teacher teaching. Nowadays, the students are so immersed in technology before they even come to us. It's amazing when kindergarten students come in, they do not know how to use a mouse on a computer because they're so used to touchscreen, everything being touch and drag. And we do online assessment with the computer and we have to teach them, the five-year-olds, how to use a mouse and click and drag and drop because it's foreign to them. Technology is so much a part of their life. They don't know when they've never experienced life without a smartphone or without a tablet in their hands. So that is their way of learning. And the curriculum has followed suit. Now all the curriculum is coming with an online component. Actually, both of our newest curriculums could be totally online only if we were a complete one-to-one district.
And one-to-one meaning every student has a device.
Exactly.
Mike Sennert is the principal of St. Joseph Grade School. As you've been hearing him say, he's also the technology coordinator for the district. I want to bring someone else into this conversation. Nicole LaFond is an education reporter with the News Gazette in Champaign and also in studio with us. Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
You cover schools all across Central Illinois. As you're hearing Mike discuss what happens in St. Joseph at grade school and throughout the district, is that a pretty common thing? Are we seeing schools able to adapt as quickly as St. Joseph has been able to?
I think it probably depends on the district. For the most part, I see most schools have some type of Chromebook or tablet device for students to use. You see the interactive whiteboards, the smart boards that almost, you know, most classrooms in a large majority of districts have those smart boards. I know that in Arcola School District, small rural school district, was one of the first to have a true one-to-one tablet device program with their students. Every student had an iPad. So I think, from my understanding, most school districts are working towards this one-to-one model.
And it sounds like it's almost easier if you're a smaller rural district to achieve that than it is if you're a larger urban district.
Right, yeah. I mean, the funding is crucial there when you have much fewer students. So,
well, and there's also some research that's been done. I know the nonprofit group Education Superhighway, in conjunction with the Illinois State Board of Education, also looked at connectivity, because that's part of this as well, right? When we have devices, we need to talk about broadband access. And they found that actually 31% of Illinois school districts don't meet student connectivity standards set by the FCC. 59% of students throughout the state don't have adequate broadband access to support digital learning. Nicole, do you think this is one of the biggest issues that school districts face, apart from funding, is just the connectivity with broadband access throughout the state?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially in Central Illinois, there's a lot of rural districts. And the way the federal government decides, you know, how much funding a district gets for E-rate, which is kind of the federal funding for connecting to the internet, basically. It's determined by low income, you know, how many students will qualify for free and reduced lunch. But it also, if you're a rural district, you're more likely to get more funding because there's those infrastructure issues and the connectivity issues. And I would say, I mean, overall, if you can't connect to the internet, what are you going to do with your devices?
Mm-hmm. So, Mike, as you talk to your colleagues throughout Central Illinois and other parts of the state, how much of broadband access is a problem? You were nodding when I was reading those statistics out from Education Superhighway.
Right. The farther you are away from a major city like Champaign-Urbana, the harder it is. We are a bedroom community, so internet access for us was not too big of an issue. Comcast is our provider we're with now, and they have the DSL clear up to 1,000 megabytes per second if we need it. But I know a small district just to the northeast of us, 5-10 miles away, there was no cable company. Satellite was not too expensive for them, and they were only to do dial-up just until like maybe 2 or 3 years ago. They were finally to get better access.
Well, and I know another issue. So we've talked about funding. We've talked about broadband access. And I know another part of this is also training teachers properly. Earlier, we spoke to Illinois State Professor Rena Shiflett on that topic. Let's hear what she had to say.
The other battle is having teachers who know how to use technology effectively instructionally, so we're not just repurposing this 21st century kinds of tools for 20th century kinds of purposes. To me, that's one of the biggest issues, is having teachers who know how to teach in a different way, more inquiry-based, more student-centered types of activities versus I'm just going to use a computer to type a paper that I could have written by hand.
Well, and I think that gets to sometimes people thinking there's been criticisms just because you give children access to tablets or they have a Chromebook, that doesn't mean that's automatically going to make them technologically savvy. Mike, how have you tackled that at St. Joseph? How have you made sure that there's enough training and that teachers are trained to use this properly?
Those are great questions. We have staff development ongoing. When we put the smart boards in a couple of years ago, we gave them the beginning instruction to it. Then we sent them back to their rooms. We said, okay, because our curriculum has smart lessons involved in it, they were able then to go to the Wonders reading series is one we used, to their online store that had these, and they could download all these different lessons that were created in the software that other teachers had posted. We also then at every faculty meeting each month would spotlight what new lessons they were doing with them and show examples to the whole staff, and it just got everyone excited. I'm noticing more and more of the young teachers coming out of the universities. They have the experience, they have the technology that they've been using for many, many years, but they necessarily don't have all of the teaching skills they need from the experience yet to properly put that in place. But now my experienced teachers are jumping headfirst into this, and they're using this technology because the kids are so excited and responding so much to it. We do bring in presenters as we need, but we found a lot of the best presenters are our own staff, the ones that have really embraced it and have done new things with the technology. They're so excited to share it with everyone else.
Nicole, what are you seeing in terms of education research? I know there's research being done all across the country here in Illinois about the impact that technology can have in the classroom on student learning.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about this last night, and a good example, the Unit 4, Champaign Unit 4 School District here in town has partnered up with the University of Illinois, the University of Chicago, and I think the National Science Foundation is involved somehow as well, but they are conducting a study right now that basically is looking at how to integrate computer coding, like learning how to write HTML and things like that, into core subjects like math. So students who are in, you know, second, third, fourth, fifth grade are learning how to, learning these coding skills while they're in math class. And, they're still, doing this study, so they're not quite sure how it's going to impact students yet. But, I would say that it'll be interesting. I don't know that we quite know exactly, how technology in the classroom will impact students down the road. I think it's a completely different, even from when I was in high school, which wasn't that long ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if we're thinking about it also, Mike, I wonder, not every child maybe has access to a computer at home.
Yes.
Or maybe they have a tablet, but they don't have a laptop, or everybody, well, most people probably have access to smartphones. But how do you work with teachers to adapt to having different degrees of access? Is that something that you also
Yes.
are talking to faculty about?
Yes, we survey our students every year when we start school again to make sure who has the technology access and who doesn't.
And what does your research show? Like for St. Joseph, what does it look like?
It is very high. It's about 95% of our families
okay.
have access.
But okay.
There are those that still don't, or like you said, only with the smartphone, which you can't do homework that way. We then provide additional resources for them. They do not, if a teacher has a class like that, they will not make any assignment online that is required without giving them time within class or within study hall to complete something like that. And there are different initiatives for online access, which local cable companies will give a reduced rate for in-home access. We have filled out the paperwork for parents before saying that they qualify for free and reduced, and they can get internet access at a very cheap rate.
That's Mike Sennert. He's a principal at St. Joseph Grade School. We're also speaking with Nicole LaFond. She's an education reporter at the News Gazette. As always, you can join our conversation. You can tweet to 21st Show. And looks like we've got a caller from Casey from Lincoln, Illinois. Casey, welcome to the 21st. What's your comment?
Hi. Just to really kind of build off what your guests are talking about, my wife is actually an English middle school teacher at New Holland Middletown, east or west of Lincoln, and they actually have a one-to-one setup there with Chromebooks on top of some other devices they've been trying to work into the system. And it's really interesting to me to see how, especially in the realm of middle school English, how that's been working. She actually has them doing podcasts, building and recording their own podcasts and of their favorite YA novels.
Oh, that sounds great.
She's had kids that have never been interested in any kind of reading whatsoever, have really been getting interested in graphic novels all the way up to full-out novels. You know, that kind of the more stereotyped children who don't want to do anything, they're now reading full-out, you know, trilogies of novels and whole series. So.
Oh, that's great. Hey, Casey, thanks for your comment, and you should put your wife in touch with us. I'm going to have the producers talk to you, and maybe some of the kids who do the podcast can come on the 21st. So hang on and make sure you give them your information. But thanks to Casey for that call. As we're thinking about that and what Casey's saying about getting kids engaged, Mike, I'm sure as a principal, that's something that you probably hear from parents also.
Yes. It seems like that when you add a technology component to the student's assignment or even a project they're working on, they just get so much more involved in it. They get so much more excited about it, and they will – we have noticed that where they've did it.
Yeah, I wonder, do you get pushback from students? Because I know that for parents, because I know that also there were previous guidelines that were, I know, very contested. The American Academy of Pediatrics had guidelines about screen time and how much that should be limited. At one point, it was just 2 hours a day. Do you hear from parents or other people? There has been pushback of people being worried that children are spending too much time with computer screens.
No, we really don't. I believe that so many of our parents are in jobs that involve technology. It's very hard to have a job anymore that doesn't involve it in some format, that they realize this is the children's future and they're going to need these skills.
Nicole, we just have about a minute or two left, but I wonder as we think about this, we started this conversation, and I don't think you can have this conversation without looking at the state funding situation for public education. You know, we heard Casey talking about, well, you've all been talking about this one-to-one goal of having one device for every student. Do you think that given the funding situation, it is more models of what we've heard from Principal Senate from Mike about it being private funding and schools raising their own money and having parents groups do that? Are there other grants that are available for schools that maybe don't have the resources or parent groups that can raise that kind of money?
Yeah, so I was actually talking to the Urbana School District Superintendent about this recently, and he was telling me how, you know, at a state funding level, there's not necessarily general state aid funds that are earmarked, you know, use this for technology. There's different programs. I think it's the Illinois Virtual Schools is one place where they put technology funding. And then these tech hubs, they're kind of regional hubs throughout the state where that kind of support school districts. And there's funding that goes there. But it's kind of it's an internal budgeting for school districts, from my understanding. I mean, it sounds like, you know, they get this general state aid and they have to decide, well, we're going to spend X amount of dollars on improving our tech this year. And it has to be a process. But as far as, you know, grants and things like that, I think that that's probably the direction of the future, it seems.
Thanks for joining us for that. Nicola Fond covers education for the News Gazette in Champaign. Thanks also to Principal Mike Sennert with St. Joseph Grade School, also technology coordinator for the district, for joining us. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Nyla Boodoo, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. We're going to be talking about jobs all week on the program as we take part in a nationwide NPR Nation Engage project. Later in the week, we're going to be talking about old and new jobs as we look at economic opportunities throughout Illinois. Today, we're focusing on employment for people who have a criminal background. This morning, the Obama administration announced that it will be providing $5 million in grants to fund job centers to help provide jobs for people coming out of prison. One of the traditional ways states have tried to help people with a criminal background background search for work is by making sure employers don't ask about an applicant's criminal history until the interview process. That's true here in Illinois. In fact, since 2010, more than 100 states, counties, and cities have introduced a so-called ban the box policy. But that effort may be backfiring. Two researchers have found the policy actually makes discrimination worse during the hiring process. It seems, according to their research, having the box removed had the effect that employers treated many Black applicants as if they all had a criminal history and called in less Black applicants for interviews. Here to explain their findings are Amanda Agin and Sonia Starr, who are the co-authors of a study called Ban the Box, Criminal Records and Statistical Discrimination, a Field Experiment. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Can one of you start by telling a little bit about what Ban the Box originally was and what it was supposed to do, Sonia?
Sure. So Ban the Box, it seeks to open doors for people with records who often face major obstacles getting jobs. And the strategy for doing so is not to prevent employers permanently from finding about criminal records, but but delaying the time at which they're able to find out about them, and specifically preventing them from asking on an initial job application or in an initial job interview about somebody's criminal record. So it's called Ban the Box because often there's like a checkbox on an application that asks, do you have a felony conviction or something along those lines. And so the idea is that if you let people get their foot in their doors and get that initial interview, and they're able to get to know the employer a little bit more, then employers won't just blanket reject them for their criminal records, but will instead give their records more nuanced consideration and not reject them unless it's job relevant.
That's Sonia Starr, a law professor at the University of Michigan. Amanda Agin is with us as well. She's at Princeton University in the Department of Economics. Amanda, what prompted you and Sonia to look into this issue?
I mean, I think we've both kind of been interested in issues of, you know, how can we help offenders after they've been released from prison? You know, these laws have been starting to become very popular across the country. You know, based on some past research and based on, in terms of the economic theory, this idea of what we're calling statistical discrimination. So you heard that title in the title of our paper, you heard that term. And the idea of statistical discrimination is that if we were going to take away information like the box from an employer before they make this decision, whether to interview the applicant or not, they might use other observable characteristics about the individual, like maybe their race in particular, to kind of guess whether that person has a criminal record. And so this could have potential adverse consequences for, say, minorities who do not have a criminal record. And so, you know, knowing this, once we saw that these policies were becoming very popular, you know, we really kind of wanted to test whether this adverse consequence was making it so that discrimination was actually increasing after these policies went into effect, rather than decreasing as many of the advocates hoped they would. And luckily, in some sense, New Jersey was passing the policy, and it was going to be going into effect at the beginning of 2015, and so we kind of decided to launch into this study.
So, Sonia, can you explain a little bit more about what you specifically did in New Jersey and what you found?
Yeah, so we ended up doing it in New York City as well as New Jersey because they both passed Ban the Box very close in time to each other. We sent close to 15,000 fake job applications, online job applications, by which I mean we applied on behalf of fictitious applicants. And this is a very classic approach to studying discrimination. And the idea is that unlike studies that use real-world data, it allows you to hold a lot of things constant. So we varied whether our applicants had a criminal record, and we varied their race, which we conveyed to the employers via racially distinctive first and last names, according to birth certificate analyses. But other than that, we basically kept the characteristics of the applicants constant, or at least they were superficially different, so the employers wouldn't recognize that they were getting two very similar applicants, but they had substantively basically the same qualifications, and we randomly varied those qualifications. And so that allows
allows you to say that, well, you know, if you see a big racial difference, for instance, it's likely because of race and not because of other differences between the applicants. And so what we did was we did that before and after Ban the Box, with the idea of both testing the extent to which criminal records themselves pose an obstacle to employment before Ban the Box, and with a also measuring racial discrimination and how that changes after Ban the Box. And we did that at some companies that had the box, that is the criminal records question, before Ban the Box went into effect, and some that never had it to begin with. And so those companies sort of served as a control. It allowed us to account for unrelated things that might have happened over the same time period that might have caused changes that were unrelated to Ban the Box. So we were able to control for those because we had this group of employers whose applications were not affected by Ban the Box at all.
And what did you all find with the findings?
So I guess we'd say first that we find support for the main reason why advocates want to implement Ban the Box policies. That is that criminal records are a major barrier to even getting your foot in the door with an employer. So at the companies that had the box, we found that our applicants that did not have a criminal record were 62% more likely to get a call back from an employer than our applicants who did have a criminal record. You know, so this is kind of a big barrier to them even trying to get a job. But unfortunately, we found a large increase in discrimination at affected employers after Ban the Box goes into effect. So at the employers who were forced to remove the box, so they had the box before the law went into effect and then had to remove it, before the Ban the Box policy goes into effect, our white applicants received about 7% more callbacks than similar black applicants. But after that policy went into effect, that increase jumped to about 45%.
I wanted to ask you, you all used the way that you sort of distinguished between races was you said you use names that might be considered historically black or not so. And I know there's a lot of research that shows that people who have names that quote unquote sound black are often discriminated against in the workplace. Was there concern in your research that that maybe that was more of a reflection than the Ban the Box initiative?
Well, first of all, we used the same thing to signal race before and after Ban the Box. That is, the same sets of names. And so it is true that the racial discrimination that we're measuring is really discrimination on the basis of sort of racially associated names. But that discrimination, which we're measuring the same way before and after, went up by quite a lot after Ban the Box. So so in terms of like what that tells us about racial discrimination as opposed to name discrimination, we think that but basically every study does it this way because employers either don't ask about race at all or they ask only on a section of the application that they say that the hiring manager will never see. And so we think that it's a pretty good measure for a few reasons. One is that a very large number of people in the real world actually do have racially distinctive names. And these are not, you know, the names that we used were very common, so they were not sort of extraordinary names. They were names, they were sort of very mainstream names, but they were nonetheless names that are strongly associated with one race or the other. It's not just black applicants that have distinctive names. More than half of white Americans, or at least in the New Jersey sample that we derived, so we based all of this on an assessment of race and names that are coded on birth certificates. And more than half of white applicants have racially distinctive names, and close to half of black applicants, and especially we're varying last names as well as first names. And so we have like a lot of, you know, Irish and Italian
or German,
sounding last names.
Okay.
So we think that this name-based discrimination is something that affects an awful lot of people in the real world. It's not just like a weird thing that we sort of created exceptional cases for our for our study. We also tried to minimize, tried to reduce anyway the socioeconomic, the differences in socioeconomic connotations between our names. You can't eliminate that entirely because our country is so socioeconomically stratified by race. That is, poverty afflicts the, is basically, strongly racially correlated. So you can't really totally eliminate, have names that are different on racial connotations, but identical on socioeconomic connotations.
And,
we did use the birth certificate data to get some socioeconomic information, and we took out names that were at the top half of, for white names, we took out names that were at the top half of the socioeconomic spectrum to try to reduce that difference.
And Amanda, did you do this with other racial and ethnic groups?
No, we did not. So we focused in this particular study on white applicants and black applicants. Of course, it would be interesting to look at other minority groups, particularly Hispanic men. One issue when you're doing a large field experiment like this is you need basically a lot of numbers in each group in order to be able to say anything about the difference between white applicants and black applicants or Hispanic applicants and black applicants. And so in the interest of being able to really nail down the appropriate numbers, we wanted to minimize the amount of comparisons that we were making. You know, so of course we think that, you know, particularly African-American men are, have a large proportion of them have criminal records, and that this policy is going to be particularly important for that group. And so we wanted to at least start with focusing on this particular comparison.
So as a reminder to our listeners, Illinois instituted the Ban the Box initiative in our state in January of 2015. I wonder if you think about how you guys think if there's a way to make this maybe more efficient. Is there a way to fix the process to do what the initiative initially intended, which was prevent discrimination against people with a criminal background and help them get back into the workforce without it backfiring against, as we're seeing maybe from this one study at least, extending it to everybody in that racial group?
Yeah, so I think that we think, first of all, that our results are sort of mixed for Ban the Box in the sense that we did find that employers complied with Ban the Box, and therefore, in a sense, Ban the Box did open doors for people with records like it's supposed to. So as far as record-based discrimination, at least at the initial callback stage, it does eliminate that problem, right? Because employers do take the box off. But then it has this racial side effect that has to be weighed against it that particularly cuts against black men that don't have criminal records who lose their ability to signify that fact. So I think, ultimately the problem, of course, comes from illegal racial discrimination, right? And if there were some way to get at that more effectively in hiring, it's already illegal, then you wouldn't have to worry about this side effect, but that's a big if. It has been illegal to discriminate on the basis of race for decades, and those laws are notoriously hard to enforce. So we have tossed around a variety of different ideas. Some of them have to do with trying to directly address racial discrimination by maybe instead of or in addition to removing criminal record information, removing information like names that gratuitously give a racial signal without having to do with qualifications. And we've also talked about ways to reduce the underlying incentive that employers have to discriminate against people with records so that they don't have to use, like, race as a workaround. And so that might involve things like, say, tax credits, expanding existing tax credits for hiring people with records, or reducing employer liability if they hire somebody with records and they commit a crime on the job, or things like that that try to get at the root underlying incentive problem.
That's Sonia Starr with the University of Michigan Law School. Thanks also to Amanda Agin with Princeton University, where she's in the Department of Economics. Their study, again, is called Ban the Box, Criminal Records and Statistical Discrimination, a Field Experiment. Thank you for being with me.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Go to www.21stshow.org for more information. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.